Let's take our Bibles tonight, open to Zechariah chapter 12. Zechariah chapter 12, which has a number of interesting references to it. It has some things in it that, I'll be very honest, I don't have the answers to. I've heard people give some answers to them, but I haven't figured them out. And I'll tell you what those are in just a minute. But let's put in it Zechariah chapter 12. And we're going to read through the whole chapter, and then we'll kind of go back through it and point out some different things in here. Verse 1, it says, "The burden of the word of the Lord concerning Israel, declares the Lord, who stretches out the heavens, lays the foundation of the earth, and forms the spirit of man within him. Behold, I am going to make Jerusalem a cup that causes reeling to all the peoples around. And when the siege is against Jerusalem, it will also be against Judah. And it will come about in that day that I will make Jerusalem a heavy stone for all peoples. All who lift it will be severely injured, and all the nations of the earth will be gathered against it. In that day, declares the Lord, I will strike every horse with bewilderment, his rider with madness, but I will watch over the house of Judah while I strike every horse of the peoples with blindness. Then the clans of Judah will say in their hearts, a strong support for us are the inhabitants of Jerusalem through the Lord of hosts our God. And in that day I will make the clans of Judah like a fire pot among pieces of wood and a flaming torch among sheaves, and so they will consume on the right hand and on the left all the surrounding peoples, while the inhabitants of Jerusalem again dwell on their own sites in Jerusalem. The Lord also will save the tents of Judah first in order, that the glory of the house of David and the glory of the inhabitants of Jerusalem may not be magnified above Judah. In that day the Lord will defend the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and the one who is feeble among them in that day will be like David, the house of David will be like God, like the angel of the Lord before them. And it will come about in that day that I will set about to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. And I will pour out on the house of David and on the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and of supplication, so that they will look on me whom they have pierced. And they will mourn for him as one mourns for an only son. And they will weep bitterly over him, like the bitter weeping over a firstborn. In that day there will be a great mourning in Jerusalem, like the mourning of Hadarimnon in the plain of Megiddo. And in the land... And the land will mourn, every family by itself, the family of the house of David by itself, the wives by themselves, the family of the house of Nathan by itself, and their wives by themselves, the family of the house of Levi by itself, and their wives by themselves, the family of the Shimeites by itself, and the wives by themselves, and all the families that remain, every family by itself, and their wives by themselves." This whole chapter is about the nations coming against Jerusalem and how God goes about defending Jerusalem. Now, the first question that I want to answer is this talking about what happened in 70 AD with Rome? And I'm going to say no. And the reason I'm going to say no in this context is when he's talking about this siege of Jerusalem in verse 2, it says in verse 3 that it will come about in that day that I will make Jerusalem a heavy stone for all the peoples. That did not happen to Rome in the conquest of Israel or the conquest of Jerusalem. And all who lift up will be severely injured. Jerusalem was not severely hurt or injured by their attack against, Rome, I think, was not severely hurt or injured by attacking Jerusalem. Jerusalem was attacked because, in fact, God brought the Romans against Jerusalem to punish Jerusalem. This now is a different matter. Okay. Then it goes on, and all the nations of the earth will be gathered against it. Again, that wasn't true. All the nations were not gathered against Jerusalem in 70 AD. Rome was gathered. Egypt wasn't gathered against it. The Persians were not gathered against it. Okay, so this is not the 70 AD siege, is what we're trying to say when he's talking about what happens here. Trying to see if there's anything else here that just might be. And that also is one of the other things, because that certainly did not happen at that time. And the other thing that happens, if you look in verse 4, "In that day declares the Lord, I will strike every horse with bewilderment and the rider with madness. But I'm going to watch over the house of Judah and strike every horse of the peoples with blindness." That didn't happen. God didn't protect Israel. He caused them to fall. Caused Jerusalem to fall to the Romans. And he didn't smite the Roman army with their horses with bewilderment didn't cause these problems at that time. The people weren't smitten with blindness. There's going to be something that God's going to do against the people that come against Jerusalem in the future. Therefore, having concluded this, I would say this is going to be Daniel's 70th week, popularly called the tribulation, but Daniel's 70th week, during the time of Jacob's trouble, or perhaps the last part of it during the Great Tribulation. Problem with this is, and this is what I'm going to say is my one problem I have when I look at this is if you look, flip over in your Bibles over to Matthew chapter 24, let's look at a couple of passages that go along with Israel and Jerusalem. Matthew chapter 24 and verse 15. It says, therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. Now, we talked about this briefly last week. This is comparable to what happened when Antiochus Epiphanes, the Greek ruler that had gone and made war in Egypt, came back and made war in Israel, and he went in, and remember, we talked about last week, he slaughtered a pig, poured out its blood on the altar, and then he went and put an image of Zeus in the Holy of Holies on top of the Ark, or in the Holy of Holies. We don't know that the Ark was there at the time that he happened to do this. I was just reading an article in the Friends of Israel magazine this last month that they were saying that the Ark of the Covenant actually was taken away and hidden underneath the Temple Mount long time before this. Whether or not that's true or not, I don't know. That writer of that said that there were supposedly a couple of rabbis that actually have testified that, yes, they've actually even gone down to the secret room and they have seen it. But that, you know, that's all hearsay. I haven't seen it. That guy hadn't seen it. He's going by some rabbis that have said it. And how do I know they're not lying to go, oh yeah, the Ark's there. It's not like people haven't done that before. That's neither here nor there. The main point here is that this is distinct from what Antiochus Epiphanes did. This is what Paul tells us is going to happen in 2 Thessalonians 2, where he says the man of lawlessness, he's actually going to go in and sit down on the ark that will be in the rebuilt temple. It's going to do something. It's going to do for them the same thing that it should have done when Antiochus Epiphanes went and put an image of Zeus in there, or the same thing that happened when temple veil was split. They should have been able to say, God's not here in our midst. They should have been able to see that, but it didn't dawn on them. But they are going to realize that when they see this man sitting in the Holy of Holies and he's breathing and he's not dead. Goes on in verse 16 of Matthew 24. And then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let those who is on the housetop not go down to get the things that are in the house. And let him who is in the field not turn back to get his cloak. But woe to those who are with child and to those who nurse babes in those days. But pray that your flight may not be in the winter or on the Sabbath. In other words, they're fleeing. They're running. Now turn in your Bibles over to Revelation chapter 12. We made reference to this last week, but we didn't come over here because I knew we'd come over here this week. When the man of lawlessness steps into the Holy of Holies and sits down, he's doing that on earth. Because remember, the earthly tabernacle is a counterpart. It's a anti-type to the type that is the heavens that that Moses saw. And so in the same way that the man of lawlessness goes into that Holy of Holies and sits down, Satan attempts to move his throne, just as he tried to move his throne back in Isaiah and Ezekiel. He again is going to try to move his throne into heaven. And this chapter tells us about a war. Verse 7 says there was a war in heaven, Michael and his angels waging war with the dragon and his angels waged war. And they were not strong enough, and there was no longer a place found for them in heaven. And the great dragon was thrown down, the serpent of old, who is called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. And I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, now the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ has come. For the accuser of our brethren has been thrown down, who accuses them before our God day and night. And they overcome him because of the blood of the Lamb, because of the word of their testimony, and they did not love their life even to the point of death. And for this reason, rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. Woe to the earth and the sea, because the devil has come down to you, having great wrath, knowing that his time is short. In other words, up until this time, Satan still obviously thinks that he can move into heaven, and he's gone and again deceived himself into thinking he can do this. But he reaches a point here which he realizes, wait a second, this doesn't work. This is the second time I've tried it. It's still not happening. And so he goes to wage war on earth now. Verse 13, and when the dragon saw that he was thrown down to the earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male, the woman being Israel, okay, not Mary. She's long gone, okay. He's talking about the nation of Israel. And two wings of the great eagle were given to the woman in order that she might fly into the wilderness to her place where she was nourished for time, times, and half a time. Relating to the Hebrew idea of time being in the dual, time being in the singular. So if you have a dual and a singular, you have three, and then a half a time makes then three and a half. So three and a half times, it tells us, from the presence of the serpent, which gives us a point of reference roughly for when this war takes place. It takes place roughly at the middle of Daniel's 70th week. And so for the last half of Daniel's 70th week, the woman is being protected by God. It goes on, but it doesn't say that she's protected in Jerusalem. It tells us in verse 14, now this is the problem, that she flies into the wilderness to her place where she is nourished. And the serpent poured out water like a river out of his mouth after the woman so that he might cause her to be swept away from the flood. But the earth helped the woman. The earth opened its mouth, drank up the river which the dragon poured out of his mouth. So the dragon was enraged with the woman and went off to make war with the rest of her offspring. And that's a reference to the 144,000. We've already been through that in Revelation. See this? Now, if you put this together and you think about this, how does this work? If in the middle of Daniel's 70th week, they see this abomination of desolation, Jesus told them to flee, they do flee according to Revelation 12, and they flee out into the wilderness. And yet in Zechariah chapter 12, it is the people in Jerusalem. So what's the situation? What do we have if the people have fled? And yet in the same way, there is a siege against Jerusalem that is taking place here. Okay.
Well, is the wilderness in Judea, or isn't Judah down in the southern part is where Judah was, wasn't it?
Yes, but the wilderness was south of there and off to the east of there, south of there.
Isn't Judah pretty deserty though, too?
But it was not called the wilderness. Okay, the term wilderness was applied to
Eden.
It was applied, yes, down to Edom, which this is where they actually end up fleeing to. Now here's a possibility, okay? One of the possibilities is that when he is talking about what's happening here, he's looking at events that are leading up to the time that this man of lawlessness comes in and sits down on the throne. And so all these other nations have come up against Jerusalem to do this, and God is providing divine protection for the people of Israel in the midst of things that are going on when these other nations are going to come against them. In fact, the book of Daniel, let's go there real quick. Flip over to Daniel, and I'll show you one thing over here in Daniel very quickly. You have to give me just a second to find this one. Daniel. Let's go to Daniel chapter 7. What would we want? Just a second. Okay, I apologize here. I wasn't planning on. I'm looking for the horns that come up, and there are three horns that are broken out. And I might be in the wrong place. Maybe this is over in Revelation.
There's 20.
720?
Seven horns were on his head, and the three fell.
There it is. Thank you, Ben. Thank you. Daniel 7, verse 20, it says, and he's looking at this beast, this fourth beast in verse 19. It says in verse 20, and it says, in the meaning of the ten horns that were on his head and the other horn that came up and before which three of them fell, namely the horn which had eyes and a mouth uttering great boasts and which was larger in appearance than its associates. And I kept looking, and that horn was waging war with the saints and overpowering them until the Ancient of Days came. So apparently what happens here is that there is a confederacy. The book of Revelation tells us there's a confederacy of ten kings. And it's out from among these ten kings that the man of lawlessness rises. He's not one of them. He's separate from the ten kings. But the ten kings give their kingdom and their allegiance to this man. Out of there, both Revelation and Daniel tell us that three of those kings decide in some way to resist him or oppose him. And we don't exactly know what they're doing when they resist and oppose him, but he then turns around and puts them down. And it's in the process, apparently, of putting them down and waging war that, according to the book of Revelation, he suffers a mortal wound. He dies, but he comes back to life, and this is then what causes him, apparently, to think, hey, I'm a god, and he goes in and sits down in there. There's the possibility that some of what's happening here involves this matter. But that still leaves the question that even then, that's only three nations, and that's not all nations that have come up against Jerusalem.
The pompous words was the midpoint, wasn't it?
Right.
So then that wouldn't fall in mind because they all run.
Right. That's when they're running. I'm saying that this is before he starts to make those pompous words, when he comes up, but he has to make war with those three kings that come against. But it still doesn't tell us how do you end up with all nations around there. So, having said all this, this is a possibility now of what he is getting at in here, and some of this will be borne out a little bit in the context. But if you go back to Zechariah chapter 12, Jesus Christ tells Israel to flee. Revelation 12 tells us that they do flee. But he also gives them the warning that if you hear about this or if you hear about that, don't go off to those places. And apparently this is exactly what happens, is that some of these do come back. They do go back to Jerusalem. Some of them, they're being protected, and some of them do return back to Judah, and some of them do return back to Jerusalem. And while they're back there then, as a result of this,
is that enough?
That he tells them,
because
what they're saying is the sign of the Son of Man. He says the sign of the Son of Man is going to be conspicuous. Everybody's going to see it.
If you say he's in the desert, he's in the
inner, or if he's in the inner room in this city, yeah. Yeah, they can't. None of them can miss that when he actually comes, because remember, God's going to cause all the planetary or all the solar lights to go out. So it's going to be completely dark. And on that dark background, God, you remember when Paul met Jesus Christ, he said he was brighter than the midday sun. This is the Son and the Father descending on the New Jerusalem. And then out of the New Jerusalem, the sun comes out of there. No one's going to be able to miss this. This huge, incredibly bright thing that's brighter than the noonday sun showing up on a completely black sky as it descends from heaven and comes down to earth. Who's going to miss that? It's been all dark. All of a sudden there's this huge bright light. You think people aren't going to be wondering, what is this thing that's approaching earth? What is this bright? It's not the sun. They're going to know it's not the sun because it's dim and it's out there and they can see it as time's passing. And I don't know how fast it's going to, how long it's going to take in terms of God letting it get here. I think long enough, at least for the earth to go a rotation so everybody on the earth can see it. Because Jesus made the statement in Matthew 24, I still
have CNN.
CNN, they might have CNN then still. Yeah.
Oh, world system will be gone.
Well, not everybody in the world has
CNN. Oh, not. World system won't be gone during the end of Daniel's seventh week. World system is still going, still trying to go strong. The world system isn't gone until Christ comes back and conquers them.
Well, you have the earthquakes, depending when that does hit. You have the one, you don't think it moved mountains and moved, that one take out a lot of stuff.
But that happens when Christ comes back and steps foot on the earth. That's when the earth is shaken with those earthquakes. Oh, no, there are earthquakes earlier.
Yeah.
But let's put it this way. In the middle of the tribulation,
which would be pretty serious.
The last half of Daniel's 70th week, when the two witnesses are in the city of Jerusalem and they're killed by the man of lawlessness, he's going to cause everybody across the face of the earth to see it, because everybody's going to know that's going to be there. So whether he does that by supernatural means or whether he uses what we call modern technology, CNN or something like that, we don't know.
They're everywhere.
I mean, the thing is, if you read prophecy guys before the advent of modern radio and television, they would say that somehow or another, supernaturally, is going to cause everybody to know this. Now, with the advent of radio and television, we assume, well, that's the way it's going to be. Or with the advent of the smartphones, everybody's going to get it twittered to them. But we don't even know that. It could completely be a supernatural thing that happens, okay, that Satan does. Whatever the case might be in this, apparently some of these people do go back. Some of these people do look at this, from what we can tell. Because we have to account some way that we do know that they leave, that they depart, but we also apparently have some that return. And even in the little bit that returns in this, it tells us in verse 5, but the clans of Judah will say in their hearts, a strong support for us are the inhabitants of Jerusalem. In other words, some of the people that are still around at that time, they're going to be looking at the people in Jerusalem as being a strong support through Jehovah of hosts, their God. So they're going to be looking, what? Zechariah 12:5. So they're going to be seeing Jehovah. See, and so now what you're beginning to see is these Jews are beginning to recognize it's not us. Jehovah's the one that's actually going to make it possible for us to be strong. And the result of that, in that day, I will make the clans of Judah. Now notice what he says clans. Clans is a word for families. So he's not talking about a whole nation. He's talking about little bitty families here and there. Why families? Because for the most part, most of the nation is out in the wilderness. What?
And the governors of Judah, you have clans.
In verse 6? Yeah.
No. That was verse. Yeah, I have the list. In the day I will remain the governors of Judah.
Yeah, the chief, the clans, the families is what it is. So what you're talking about is those that are representing the families in this situation here. Okay? And so he's looking at them, and he says, they're like a fire pot amongst the wood and a flaming torch among the sheaves. In other words, they're fire among dry tinder. Simple terms. So they will consume on the right hand on the left. While the inhabitants of Jerusalem will dwell on their own sites in Jerusalem. In other words, those that are in Jerusalem are still being divinely protected. Now I want to show you something about these people in Jerusalem, what happens here towards the end. If you flip back over to Revelation for a minute, in the last half of the last half of Daniel's 70th week, we're going to go to Revelation 13. Revelation 11, 13, not 13. Revelation 11, 13. Sorry. In Revelation 11, we're in the last half of the tribulation period, and there are these two witnesses of God that are sent into the earth. They are killed, and then verse 11 says, and after 3.5 days, the breath of life from God came into them. They stood on their feet. Great fear fell upon those who were beholding them, and they heard a loud voice from heaven saying to them, come up here. They went up into heaven in the cloud, and their enemies beheld them. In that hour, in that very moment that they're caught up to heaven, it tells us here, there was a great earthquake, and a tenth of the city fell. Now, if that happened today, if you had an earthquake and a tenth part of the city collapsed, we'd say that's a pretty significant earthquake. That's pretty. The result of it is, and 7,000 were killed in the earthquake. Now, again, 7,000 is not a number to sneeze at. But in terms of all the people that are there, it's still somewhat small. I mean, you and I would be very upset if 7,000 people were killed in an earthquake. Like I said, it's nothing to sneeze at. But it's showing you that there are still a lot of people here in this area. And God is protecting these people, Israel, in the midst of these things, as because what's going to happen, verse 14 says, this is the second woe, behold, the third one is to come. And the third one is the actual appearing of Christ, coming down, setting foot, conquering, and setting up his kingdom. Okay. And that's going to take place. So I'm trying to show you that it's right here towards the end for any of these people that have gone back here to this city. God is divinely providing this protection for these people, as well as dealing with all these nations that have come against them. Two of these people are going to be two witnesses, but they're actually sent there by God. They're not running back to check out and see what's happening. It's a different situation. So back in Zechariah chapter 12 then. Because there's one other thing that we want to point out about what's happening. Because in verse 6 it says, in that day then I will make the clans of Judah like a fire pot among the pieces of wood, flaming torch among the sheaves. They will consume on the right hand and on the left all the surrounding peoples, while the inhabitants of Jerusalem again dwell on their own sites in Jerusalem. And the Lord also then will save the tents of Judah. Now, why does he say tents? That's distinct from what you have in verse 6, where you have them dwelling and you have them inhabited in their places. Here you have people that are in tents. Tents implies what? It's what?
Temporary.
Thank you, Gary. Temporary. Tents implies something temporary. What's the other, where was the other famous place that Israel lived in tents? In the desert, in the wilderness, which is where these people are at. And before Jesus Christ, well, let's finish this. And so the Lord also will save the tents of Judah first in order, that the glory of the house of David and the glory of the inhabitants of Jerusalem might not be magnified over Judah. Where's the house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem? They're in Jerusalem. The house of David was there. That's where his palace was. His family was associated with the city of David in the southern portion. Remember, Solomon went and David moved his place up close to where the... Actually, that's not right. It was down in the city of David. And he set up the tabernacle across from where he was dwelling. It's when Solomon, because we just got done reading that, when Solomon built the temple up in the northeast quarter of the city, he built his palace close to that, in close proximity to that.
It seems like it's multiple events going on.
It is multiple events. And this is what we're trying to point out. House of David, inhabitants of Jerusalem, they don't get, God does not divinely come and deliver them first. He delivers who first, according to verse 7? Yeah, the ones that are in the tents. And where are these people? We just talked about this a little bit ago. They fled to the wilderness. And let's point out a passage. We've been over this before, but if you look in Isaiah chapter 63, Ben was, I think, making reference to this a little bit ago. But in Isaiah 63 and verse 1, it says, who is this who comes from Edom with garments here that are bright colors from Bozra? Now, Bozra was, let's put it this way, they don't know for sure where Bozra is at. Okay. They've got a couple of locations where they think that's at, but they do know it's in Edom because it tells you it comes from Edom. This one who is majestic in his apparel, marching in the greatness of his strength, it is I who speak in righteousness, mighty to save. Why is your apparel red? It's Adam. It's the word for Adam. Okay, red, because that apparently that was a Adam. Despite the Sunday school papers, didn't look like you and I from what he's called. He was earthy looking. Yeah, I don't know if it's not the same word, but it's similar. Yeah, it's not with Edom like that. Yeah, red and ruddy, and this is Adam. And it says, your garments are like one who has tread the winepress. So he sees that his garments are red, but they look red like somebody that's been stomping in the grapes, which would mean you're not red all over. You're splattered with red. Okay. unless you lay down in the grapes, but this says treading the grapes, which is what he did. He says, I have trodden the wine trough alone, and from the peoples there was no man with me. I also trod them in my anger, and here it is, trampled them in my wrath, his fury, and their lifeblood is sprinkled on my garments, and I stained all my raiment. For the day of my vengeance was in my heart, and my year of redemption has come. So the first thing Jesus Christ does when he comes to the earth, before he touches foot on the Mount of Olives and deals with what's going on at Jerusalem, before he does that, Zechariah says he goes and deals with those people that are in the wilderness, those people that are in the tents, because he wants to make sure that they know they are as important as the house of Judah and as important as Jerusalem itself.
God provided them tents because they're not supposed to go back for anything.
Right. Well, but it doesn't actually, I mean, we can say the Lord also will save the tents of Judah, but see, tents of Judah can simply be, it could literally be that they're in tents, but it could also be a reference to the fact that they're not living at home.
Or it could mean that they're living
at home. Yeah, they could, because it.
Well, it's like they went to Mexico, they just had a stick of a piece of thing that they got.
Oh, yeah, we saw all kinds of those. If you go home and you look up Feast of Tabernacles, New York City, you've seen pictures of these people that go out and they'll shut down whole streets, and the people will move out of their apartment buildings, and they'll come down, and these Jews will, in certain quarters of the city, will set up booths in the streets. They don't go out and set up a tent from Sears or from REI or something like that. They're supposed to build these booths themselves. So very likely that's what these people are doing. Exactly that idea. That they're scavenging whatever they can find to give them some shelter out there. They're divinely protected by God, but, you know, sun still might be shining. At least during part of this towards the end. During part of the last 3.5 years, it's going to be shining. It doesn't quit shining until, you know, a little closer towards the end. You know, so anyway, but the significance of this is he goes and deals with them down in the wilderness, and then he comes to Jerusalem on the Mount of Olives. But his garments are already splattered. He's already been meeting out judgment, and he started down there. Why? Exactly, it tells you here. So that the glory of the house of David and the glory of the inhabitants of Jerusalem should not be magnified above Judah. In other words, he doesn't want, some people think we were more important and he came to us first. It would be like if in our country, if there was an attack on our country, it would be as if you sent the military out here to Washington and Oregon to rescue us before you went to Washington, D.C. You know, so that Washington, D.C. would say, well, we're the most important place on the planet. Well, you know, the army could say, well, we're going to take care of everybody and we'll get to you guys, but we're going to take care of these guys first. That's what Jesus Christ does. I don't know if that's a good analogy, but hopefully it makes the point. Verse 8, and in that day, then the Lord will defend then the inhabitants of Jerusalem, that those people that are left there, those that remnant, and I would basically say that's what you're looking at. You're looking at a remnant of people that are there, because most of them aren't in this area at this time. And it says, and the one who is feeble among them in that day will be like David. You never would have thought of David as a feeble man, at least not until he got old. David was a strong guy. Remember what the song that the women sang that got Saul upset? Saul's killed his thousands, and David's killed his 10,000. Boy, that would kind of irk you, wouldn't you? If you were a military king like Saul, you know, to hear them. But is that a feeble guy? David was not a feeble guy. I mean, what did David even say? The Lord, he took care of a lion, took the sheep, went out and took the lion, or killed the lion, took the sheep back. Bear came. I mean, That's no young pup there that's doing that. That's somebody that's got some know-how and some strength to him. And it says in that day, and the house of David will be like God, like the angel. In other words, their strength is going to be very powerful. It's going to be like divine power in terms of what they're able to do. And it will come about in that day that I will set about to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem, which is exactly what Jesus Christ does. If we would have gone on to the next, to the last woe, the seventh trumpet over there when we were in Revelation 11, it says the seventh one, it says that the kingdoms of the world have become the kingdoms of our Lord and of his Christ. He comes back and he conquers them all. And this is what's happening here. Verse 10, in connection with that, he pours out on the house of David, and on the inhabitants of Jerusalem, because they see this at this time. In other words, this connection with his coming there to the Mount of Olives and dealing with those people there in this area. The spirit of grace and of supplication. Interesting enough, the word grace and supplication are related words. The word supplication means to ask for grace. It's a verb related to the word can. And keep in mind, it's translated grace, but it does not have the punch that our term grace does. We're going to talk about that on Sunday morning a little bit. But it says the spirit of grace and of supplication. And then they will look. They're going to fix their gaze on. This isn't a glance on me whom they have pierced. Not the same word that's used for the piercing of him over in Isaiah 53. It's a different word. Okay. But it is nonetheless significant. If you want the place where this is, if you don't already have, if your Bible doesn't have anything, I should look to see what my margin has. 10b. Oh, mine goes to John 19:37, which is where this is quoted as a fulfillment. But if you want an Old Testament verse that uses this word, Numbers 25:8 has the situation. Remember where the Ammonite women were coming up and they were carrying on with affairs and everything, and right in front of the elders, right in front of Moses and the people, while they're weeping at the doorway of the tabernacle, one of the men walks through with a woman and takes an Ammonite woman right into his tent. And Phinehas, Aaron's grandson, goes and grabs a spear and runs in it, runs them both through in the belly together. They're both a shish kebab on the end of a stick, both of them together. And it stops the raging of God's wrath on the people. Now that's
the pierce.
That's the pierce. That's one of the places where this word pierce occurs.
Numbers 25:8.
So just kind of an interesting. So and what did they do with Jesus Christ? They definitely took a spear and they definitely pierced his side. Which may tell you, if that's the idea, that it's not just that they just kind of stuck him in the side a little bit. This may mean that they, I mean, let's put it this way. If they ran it inside, they had to stick the end of that spear in there far enough that it actually went in to puncture his heart so the blood and water ran out. So it ran in there pretty good. So, you know.
I think it's amazing that since they look on me, when they appear, and they will mourn for him.
Yeah. So you have a person who is deity.
Well, they've been mourning.
Making reference to himself. And it says, and they will mourn, but this is a mourning for him. See, up to this point, they haven't, because they haven't recognized who he is, but now they see him, and now they're mourning over the circumstances changes. It becomes a mourning because they realize they were culpable for the death of Christ.
They see him and then they go, that's God. So that'd be Romans...
Yeah, Romans 11, when all Israel will be saved. Yeah. It says, and they will mourn for him as one mourns for an only son. I know it says there for an only son, and they will weep bitterly over him like the bitter weeping over a firstborn. I'm not going to ask Ed to answer this question, but I'm going to venture, even though he's got three boys, he'd lose any one of them, he'd weep a lot. He's not going to say, well, I'm going to weep a lot more because Joseph was the firstborn. Joshua, oh yeah, well, a little weeping for... But you get the point. In their culture, this really was a big deal. More so for us. To us, we don't treat the kids with that. You're the firstborn. You know, you're the heir. It's not as big a deal for us. For them, always a very big deal. You lose your firstborn, that was your heir. That was the one. Everything was entrusted to that one.
Well, if you died, it was the second one.
It did, but the thing was, is the firstborn was being groomed. And you lose that one. You're not grooming number two. You're grooming number one. All your work, all your effort. He's your protege. He's the one that's going to carry on the family name. That's very important. And so just to put this in perspective, because we read this, and I think you can all get it. If you lost a child, you'd mourn over them. But they would make much bigger production out of mourning over an only son and over your firstborn. That would definitely be a bigger deal for them. And it says, and in that day there will be a great mourning in Jerusalem, like the mourning of Hadarimnon in the plain of Megiddo.
Would that be connected to Matthew 24:30?
I don't know what Matthew 24:30 says.
And the whole world will be mourning. Everyone in the world will
be mourning. I can't answer that without going and looking at the context. I got to see what the rest of that verse says. He is making a reference to a specific event in history here, though, that these people could have related to. We'll talk about that in a minute. And then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming. This mourning here in verse 30, they're mourning because they're lamenting the fact that he's coming. This is different than Israel. Israel's mourning because they're going, we killed our king. These people are mourning, oh, hope is all lost. He's going to beat us. How can we beat him? So it's a different kind of grief.
But at the same time, possibly.
Well, it is connected with it. Because that has to do with when he's coming. That actually is when they see him coming out of the New Jerusalem. This is actually when he's coming up to the city of Jerusalem. So this is going to be connected with that, but it's going to be down the road a little bit. Now the situation, the event that you have in Zechariah 12:11, the Hadarimnon, had to do with one of the greatest kings of Israel, Josiah. He was the one that comes up. He becomes a king at, what, I think 8 years of age. And he eventually gets trained by, there's a priest that takes him and trains him and teaches him. And pretty soon he's thinking, you know, we're not doing this. But the things that we should be doing is we're reading. And then they go up and they say, well, let's try to fix the temple. And they fix the temple. They go, oh, we found something at the temple. It's a book. It's a law. And they read it. And they're like, we're not doing this. One of the things, if you never forget this, the significance of them going, we found the book of the law. God gave them specific instructions in Deuteronomy. He says that at such a time that you desire to have a king, for you will want a king someday. He even said that in Deuteronomy. I know you're going to want a king one day. And when you get that king, one of the things that that king is supposed to do is he is supposed to make a copy of the law for himself. I don't think it says you're supposed to hire scribes to make a copy. I think literally he was supposed to sit down and copy it for himself. I don't know. In church history, it used to be in the Greek or the Orthodox churches, the churches of the East, not the Roman church, but in the Eastern church during the Middle Ages. Every man, before he could leave his training and go out to take a church or go into ministry, had to make a copy of the Greek New Testament, because they still had the Greek New Testament over there. They had Latin over in Rome, but they had a Greek. He had to make a copy of it for himself. That really familiarizes yourself. I've thought about that. I sat one day and copied one whole page, looked at my watch and thought, and that's with a nice pen that I don't have to keep digging in an inkwell. I've got really nice, fine, easy paper. I can't imagine what that must have been like to do that. But the thing is, it does is it gets, it's just like reading through the Bible every year. Peg and I have been doing this for several years, and you read through it, and it's still, you read through it going, I don't remember reading this before. Wow. What, we're going, look at that. Isn't that an interesting, I don't know if sometimes you space off and when you're reading. Anyway, sorry, I'm getting sidetracked. But Josiah is the one where they bring the law back. He reinstitutes, and he makes all kinds of reforms. He makes reforms that they hadn't made in the land for a long time. He takes everything down. All the pillars, all the altars of Baal and Asherah, all over the land. They even go out and dig up the bones of all the false prophets and they burn them on the altar. Which, interestingly enough, was exactly, we just read that the other night, which is exactly what the prophet prophesied to Jeroboam, is exactly what's going to happen with your altars that they set up. They're going to dig up, they're going to burn the bones and the ashes and all this. Anyway, Josiah, at the end, Pharaoh Necho was heading up to Carchemish to make war with the Babylonians, or the Assyrians. Babylonians, I can't remember, I just read this, but and he decides to go out to me, and God says, don't go out, Josiah, just stay home. But Josiah thinks, no, he should go out and make war with you for some reason, and he doesn't obey God. Even though he's obeyed God all through his life, and he doesn't at the end, and he gets killed. And there was, tells us here, and it happened in the Valley of Megiddo. That's where he was shot, which would be to the north and west of Jerusalem. So they went out. That's where they met the Egyptian army. This is where he shot up there. And there was a great mourning in Hadarimnon in the plain of Megiddo. Because this great king that had made all these reforms and cleaned up the land is killed. He says, that is, for these people that could think back, when Zechariah was writing this, Because I don't know if anybody was still alive at this time, but there are people that probably lived close enough to this that they probably heard their grandparents talk about what it was like the day Josiah died and everything that had happened back then. I might be wrong on that. I might, the calendar might be a little bit too far, but anyway. And they could tell you, tell this, and you could think. It's just like me. I didn't live through December 7th, 1941, but my grandparents did. My grandparents can tell you what that was like.
I bet you can tell about the Twin Towers.
I see, that's a story I could tell you about, yeah.
I mean, things that you just remember.
And there's a now a generation of kids that weren't alive then that don't, they don't know what that is. They've grown up anyway. And it says in verse 12, and the result of the mourning, it says, and the land will mourn. So this mourning that they do, this is interesting. This is not, usually mourning for them was a thing where you got everybody together and you all wail and you mourn. Remember in Lazarus when he dies? There's all these people that have come out to weep and to mourn with Mary and Martha. So there's a thing, but this tells you, everybody's going to do it. But they're all doing it by themselves. Because this isn't about a show. This is real mourning that these people are doing because these are all people that are stricken with grief. And so it says, and the land will mourn, every family by itself, family of the house of David by itself, and their wives by themselves. The men and women aren't together in this. The family of the house of Nathan by itself, their wives by them. You know, she's showing you that they're split off. Now when he says the family of the house of David, that's looking at all of them. But then he takes a subset of the family of the house of David, the family of Nathan, which is significant because who did Christ descend from? Nathan. What? Christ descended from Nathan, out of David. He was the child that he descended from. Okay, if I remember correctly, Joseph, had Jesus really been Joseph's son, he couldn't have been king because he came through Solomon, who ended up being... ended up having the son Jeconiah that was written childless.
The curse of
Jeconiah. Yes, exactly. Then in verse 13, in the family of the house of Levi by themselves and its wives by themselves, and the family of the Shimeites. This is interesting. The Shimeites are mentioned two times in the Bible. They're mentioned here, and they're mentioned, I wrote this down on my here. No, no, that was another guy. There was a guy by the name of Shimei. That was doing that. But this is Numbers 3:21. The Shimeites were a division within the Levitical family. So they were part of, so just as Nathan is a subset of David, the Shimeites, so he takes one of the families to show you, see, all the families mourning, but they're mourning in their separate little clans. And so the Levites are mourning, the Shimeites by themselves. One of the subsets, if you were to go back to Numbers 3:21, my Bible doesn't have a reference to it in here. I had to go up and look that one up, but they're mentioned over there among the Levites. They weren't priests. They were some of the Levites that had charge of other matters with regard to the temple and the tabernacle and such, so they weren't actually the priests. And all the families that remain, every family by itself and their wives by themselves. So everybody's going to mourn at that time. They're all going to see him. They're all going. And I don't know how they're going to recognize that this is who this is. It's not going to be like, what was it, Reverend Sun Young Moon that was being tried on tax evasion or tax dodging or something. And they brought him in the court and he was talking about the church that he set up and he said that Jesus had appeared to them. They said, well, how did you know it was Jesus? And he says, I recognized him by his picture. Well, I don't. We have no inclination what Jesus actually looked like. And he probably didn't really look like the popular Jesus that you see in paintings over the centuries. But whatever he does, somehow or another, these people are going to recognize this is who this is. And I think that they're probably going to recognize it because they're going to be seeing that it's fulfilling scripture that they has been specifically prophesied to them. And they're going to say that this is going to happen. But even more so, it tells you in verse 10, it's because the Spirit's poured on them. So I think part of the way they recognize it, it's a special divine revelation from the Holy Spirit that's going to say, that's the one we rejected. I'm responsible for his death. And the thing is, these people at this time, had any of them been there to vote for his death? No. None of these people, when this is going to happen, because it's going to be so far removed, were responsible for his death directly by voting for it. But I think it's illustrative of even the fact you and I are guilty of the death of Christ. Because it was our sins, our willing disobedience, that made him go to the cross.
You're making a point of mourning in those three chapters.
Yeah.
Six times.
Yeah.
Grieving, mourning.
You'd think that they'd be really excited to see him. And I think that they're going to, well, they are going to be excited to see him. But there's definitely a time of mourning that they go through because they realize their responsibility. They recognize that they're culpable for what took place. Just trying to see if there's anything else. You probably, if you have a good reference Bible, they probably have marginal references to John 19, 37, about looking on the one that they pierced, like that. Hopefully, if you don't have any references, I don't have a reference for verse 11 where it talks about the mourning over Josiah. I have a reference on that verse, but it doesn't go back to that. If you want references for that, 2 Kings 21:29 is what I had. 23. Okay, I probably wrote it down wrong then. Let's see. I'm sure the editors of your Bible did a better job double checking than I did. Anyway, yeah, the other one was 1937, Ben. Yes.
One thing that I always try to keep in mind when looking at prophecy is that passage in. I think it's in Matthew, where Jesus goes into the synagogue and reads from the book of Isaiah, and reads some passage, and it says, "Today this day has been fulfilled in your midst." And if you go back and read, he stops in the middle of the verse, and the second verse, he didn't say that was being fulfilled, and it's pretty clearly future. And so it always makes me think that there might be something else that we don't understand because it's kind of all together.
Right. This is all compressed, and yet it's not saying that this is all one event that all happens,
right.
Boom, all right together. Yeah.
Yeah. And yet when it is fulfilled,
it'll all make perfect sense.
This is where.
Because, you know, you can easily read a lot of stuff in the Old Testament now and go, oh, Christ, that happened, and it's plain.
Yeah, so when you're going through this passage here in Zechariah chapter 12, yeah, he definitely isn't just giving you, he isn't taking the last 10 minutes or the last 10 days and giving you a blow-by-blow account of this and this and this and this. You know, I think most of what's happening here all fits within the last 3.5 years of Daniel 7. I think, but 3.5 years is a lot of time. There's a lot of things that go on within that period of time in connection with that. So. Okay. So the main point, there is a main point to this. The main point in this passage has to do with God prophesying here to these people that have come, returned to Jerusalem, rebuilt. And last week we looked at the judgment on the flock and the shepherds. Now you come to this and he's looking at judgment on Jerusalem, but his divine deliverance of Jerusalem and the inhabitants of Jerusalem in the future. So he's anticipating a time in which these people can't imagine again having been under siege. They've just returned. And, well, relatively, they've been there about 16 or 17 years by this time. And he's done, there's another time coming. This is going to be under siege again. But I'm going to deliver at that time. Again, meaning that it can't be the 70 AD event. So he's encouraging them with that what he's going to do for these people. Okay, anything else to add? In 70 AD,
yeah.
These people, yeah. And it really, it's important because you have you've got a real strong movement within Christendom of individuals today that are, they call themselves preterists, that they try to make almost all these things, all these judgment prophecies fulfilled in 70 AD. And yet, I don't know how you could read this passage and say that this was, because God didn't deliver the people of Israel. He didn't punish Rome. Eventually, the Roman Empire fell, but the Roman Empire didn't fall until, was it in the 400s? Into the 5th century, I believe it was, is when the Roman Empire began to really fall apart, when the Goths started coming down out of the north into Italy. Anyway, the thing is that it was a long time down the road. He didn't punish him at that time. And all the nations didn't come against him. I mean, that's what we're just trying to point out. If you look at it, take what he says in the context, the things that happened in 70 AD didn't happen here. It's a different event. So let's close in with a word of prayer. Father, again, we're thankful for your word. Though Zechariah 12 isn't written to us about our circumstances in that regard, Lord, it does encourage us that you had made promises to your people Israel, and you will be faithful to fulfill them. And your people Israel, as well as Jerusalem and Judah, they have a purpose in your future. And it's not as a part of the church, and it's not that we're a part of them. They have a purpose distinct from us, and we're thankful that you will faithfully fulfill that. And we then also have the assurance that you will faithfully fulfill the promises that you have made to us. Thankful for this time together, for those of you brought out, and as always, for your faithfulness, both that which you show to your people Israel and the faithfulness that we get to experience every day. Amen.
So, all those battles.